Chapter 14 The Secret Plans to End American Democracy. The Incident. The two terms of George W. Bush saw passage of the Patriot Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and other similar laws in the wake of 9/11. Afghanistan and Iraq were invaded, and detention centers for terrorists established. The official word? The erosion of civil liberties, including wiretapping and torture and suspending habeas corpus, is necessary in order to prevent the spread of terrorism on our shores. My take. The federal government and elements of the military have used 9/11 as an excuse to put in place the means to impose martial law and lock up dissenters in camps if they deem it necessary. Our Constitution and Bill of Rights have never been in greater peril than now. The technology exists to further erode our democracy and basically make slaves of those who won't go along with the program. With a fascist, the problem is never how best to present the truth to the public, but how best to use the news to deceive the public into giving the fascist and his group more money or more power. American fascism will not be really dangerous until there is a purposeful coalition among the cartelists, the deliberate poisoners of public information. They claim to be super patriots, but they would destroy every liberty guaranteed by the Constitution. Henry Wallace, Vice President of the United States, 1944. What transpired during the Bush II years has been coming out in dribs and drabs so as not to unduly alarm the populace. President Obama wants to look forward and put all that behind us. But when our own government has sanctioned torture and even murder in the name of national security, I don't see how we can. We need accountability from our government so as not to unduly alarm the populace. President Obama wants to look forward and put all that behind us. But when our own government has sanctioned torture and even murder in the name of national security, I don't see how we can. We need accountability from our government, and if that means even a Cheney or Rumsfeld standing trial for war crimes, so be it. The Senate Armed Services Committee came out with a report in April 2009 that said, "The abuse of detainees in U.S. custody cannot simply be attributed to the actions of a few bad apples acting on their own. The fact is that senior officials in the United States government solicited information on how to use aggressive techniques, redefined the law to create the appearance of their legality, and authorized their use against detainees. I was waterboarded during my Navy training at SEER, Survival Escape Resistance and Evasion School, to know what it's like in case we ever became POWs, and it is a method of torture. Cheney's word for it is enhanced interrogation. Well, you give me Dick Cheney and a waterboard for an hour, and I'll have him confessing to the Sharon Tate murders." Not too long ago, the ACLU managed to pry loose government documents, including a CIA manual about what they call extraordinary rendition. It describes the capture shock that happened before a detainee got put on the flight to some overseas prison. Little techniques, like being shackled and bound up in blindfolds and hoods so you couldn't see or hear. After which you'd get stripped down and shaved and have your picture taken. Not to mention walling, defined as slamming somebody's head against the wall, but with certain protective measures so they don't die. You get the picture. We all remember the gruesome images of Abu Ghraib, but the CIA admits having destroyed hundreds of hours of coercive interrogation videotapes that took place in secret prisons. Don't you find it pretty sadistic that they'd even want to make movies of all this? These are measures I've always associated with the KGB or the Nazis. Come to find out from a Senate Armed Services Committee report on prisoner abuse that they even created an experimental battle lab for the torture program at Guantanamo, and a throwback to MK Ultra. What galls me more than anything is how they use torture in pursuit of lies to justify their actions. First of all, Bush and Cheney pressured lawyers at the Department of Justice to produce memos authorizing them to do whatever they wanted and call it legal. Then, in the weeks just before we invaded Iraq and the first couple of months of our occupation, there turned out to be major spikes in the harshest torture techniques. It was all part of an attempt to link Saddam Hussein to al-Qaeda. Major Paul Burney, who was part of the Guantanamo interrogation team, told investigators, "The more frustrated people got in not being able to establish this link, there was more and more pressure to resort to measures that might produce more immediate results." After Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi was captured, the CIA rendered him to Egypt. The term reminds me of what we do to slabs of beef. There he was tortured into making a false confession that Saddam had gotten information about use of chemical and biological weapons from a couple of al-Qaeda operatives. Al-Libi was a supposed suicide in a Libyan jail in May 2009. Speaking of al-Qaeda, I recently came across this point. Should the members of the 9/11 Presidential Commission not have been informed that two of the key witnesses upon whom their report was based had provided the information to the report's conclusions only after being waterboarded a total of 266 times? How low would these guys stoop? We've learned since Bush left office of a meeting he had with Tony Blair to talk about how the United Nations inspectors weren't going to find any weapons of mass destruction, but why not go ahead anyway? A memo written early in 2003 has Bush telling Blair of a U.S. plan to fly U-2 reconnaissance aircraft painted in U.N. colors over Iraq with fighter cover. If Saddam fired at them, he'd be in violation of the U.N. resolutions, and that would be ample justification to invade. Sounds like a transplant of Operation North Woods to me. We may never know how many detainees died in our custody in secret prisons. We do have fresh evidence, though, of an executive assassination ring that was revealed by investigative journalist Seymour Hersh in March 2009. Hersh spoke of an independent special wing called Joint Special Operations Command that reported directly to Cheney's office. Word was that a 3-star admiral eventually ordered it stopped because so many collateral deaths were happening. It pains me to say that among the unit's trainees were young men from the Navy SEALs. By last summer of 09, word was out about a clandestine CIA program to assassinate al-Qaeda members. The private company enlisted was identified as Blackwater, which started out protecting our brass in Iraq. Today, even though the Iraqi government has kicked them out, they're still under contract to our own government for black ops. I read a chilling book about Blackwater by Jeremy Scahill that I highly recommend. They're in the vanguard of privatization of our armed forces. It's astounding to consider that we have more private soldiers, 74,000, than uniformed troops, 57,000, in Afghanistan as of summer 2009. Blackwater, which recently changed its name to the more innocuous-sounding XE Services, is run by Eric Prince, who one former employee says views himself as a Christian crusader tasked with eliminating Muslims and the Islamic faith from the globe. After getting some bad press for mowing down 17 Iraqi civilians on a crowded street in 2007, the company set about to clean up its image. They don't call themselves mercenaries anymore, but global stabilization professionals. Their website claims a corporate vision guided by integrity, innovation, and a desire for a safer world. They sponsor NASCAR events and even have performed dramatic parachute landings at college football games. Blackwater, as Eric Prince puts it, is going to be more of a full-spectrum operation. Wonder what full-spectrum means. One arm of Blackwater is called Total Intelligence Solutions, run by J. Kofor Black, who used to head up the CIA's counterterrorism branch. The company has bid for a $15 billion Pentagon contract to fight terrorists with drug trade ties. They've got an offshore affiliate, Greystone Limited in Barbados. And while Iraqi civilians are suing Blackwater for murders and other war crimes, the Obama administration has replaced them with a new outfit called Triple Canopy, giving the company a billion-dollar contract to provide private security services in Iraq. Not only did they hire some of Blackwater's finest, but some company employees have claimed Triple Canopy has used stolen cars and weapons taken from Iraqis to lift their profits on certain contracts to more than 40%. Meantime, Blackwater also remains on our government payroll to arm drone aircraft in Afghanistan, among other lucrative missions. After Katrina devastated New Orleans in 2004, Blackwater got itself a mission there, too. About 150 of its mercs fanned out around the city in full battle gear, carrying automatic assault weapons and with guns strapped to their legs. When Jeremy Scahill talked to four of the men, they described their work as securing neighborhoods and confronting criminals on behalf of Homeland Security. I find it so disturbing that our country is allowing professional mercenaries to take over protection of our nation. If that's the case, what do we need the military for at all? In Iraq, Ambassador Bremer went over and absolved them of anything they did. They could literally commit murder and just walk away. If because of terrorism, laws don't matter anymore, then we're no better than the terrorists. We can't just have the law when it's convenient. But this is only one of a host of assaults on our Constitution and the Bill of Rights since the events of 9/11. We would do well to review elements of the USA Patriot Act, passed by Congress a month after the attacks. Among other things, the new law made it a crime for anybody to contribute money or material support for a group that appeared on the terror watch list. It allowed the FBI to monitor and tape record conversations between attorneys and clients, once considered privileged. It let the FBI order librarians to turn over information about people's reading habits, and it opened the door for government surveillance on our emails and snail mails. So it's no surprise that the Bush administration soon embarked on an illegal wiretapping program, a story that the New York Times sat on for a year before finally publishing it. The National Security Agency, NSA, set up a secret room in downtown San Francisco under the auspices of AT&T, where the NSA could tap into the telecom's giant fiber-optic cables. These weren't just part of AT&T, but connected their network to Sprint, Global Crossing, and other companies, including Quest, which had refused to play ball. According to former AT&T technician Mark Klein, the result was a complete copy of the data stream. It all went through NSA headquarters at Fort Meade, 10 miles outside D.C., where the agency has a colossal Cray supercomputer, codenamed the Black Widow. Don't you love all these black designations? This supercomputer is capable of scanning millions of domestic and international phone calls and emails per hour, performing hundreds of trillions of calculations per second. It searches through and reassembles key words and patterns across many languages. They targeted certain journalists and basically vacuumed in all the domestic communications of Americans, including faxes, phone calls, and internet traffic. Codenamed Pinwheel, the NSA's secret database even scooped up the private emails of former President Clinton. What's truly outrageous is that all this was legalized when Bush signed into law the FISA Amendments Act of 2008. FISA stands for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. That's right. Congress gave the NSA still more power to ferret out supposed terrorist patterns in our private communications. This gives AT&T, Verizon, and the rest a hearty signal to go on pimping for the government. After writing that column, Nat Hentoff, who'd been with the Village Voice since it started in the mid-1950s, got laid off. Snooping through our telecoms was only the beginning. Even after Congress held back funding for the Suspicionless Surveillance Program developed by a new Total Information Awareness Department, don't you just love the labels? Bush apparently kept it going anyway. This was broader than the warrantless wiretaps, giving law enforcement the right to inspect our credit cards and bank transactions on the off chance we might be tied into terrorists. In shooting an episode called Big Brother for my TV series, my son Ty and I came to Minneapolis to film a little B-roll. We went downtown to 1st and Washington Avenue. There wasn't one camera. There were four, on every single street corner. A middle-aged guy came by on a bike, and I stopped him to ask if he'd ever noticed this. He said, "No, what are they filming?" I told him, "I don't know, but obviously they're watching us. They've got every direction covered." I found out that private corporations provide the money to buy the cameras. The city says, "Great, it doesn't cost us a thing." And the taxpayers say, "Great, my taxes don't go up." But are the corporations doing this out of the goodness of their heart, to make a safer America? The cameras are all run by computer. One thing that automatically triggers them is when four or more people are together. Must be up to something. Let's film them. We were all outraged and stunned when we read George Orwell's 1984 in school, but I'm afraid he was a prophet. Big Brother is watching, and it's happening in subtle ways. I imagine few of you have heard of InfraGuard. A year ago, I was happily ignorant that it existed. Their brochure describes a collaborative effort between government and private industry to protect our critical infrastructures like banking and finance, agriculture and food, telecommunications, transportation systems, and the like. An InfraGuard member is a private sector volunteer with an inherent concern for national security, says the brochure. Their members connect to a national network of subject matter experts, SMEs for short, and communicate through local chapters with federal law enforcement and government agencies. It looks completely up and up. As of early 2008, InfraGuard had 86 chapters around the country, representing more than 23,000 figures in private industry. Over 350 of the Fortune 500 companies are said to be involved. If they follow what the pamphlet says, these are patriotic Americans who meet with agents from the FBI and Homeland Security to help protect the rest of us. Okay, fine and dandy. But I see this as ripe for massive abuse, and I despise the premise of members watching other people and reporting what they see to the government. I learned they have a couple of meetings a month, and every group has its own handler, who is an FBI agent. I met personally with two of the upper echelon of InfraGuard in Oklahoma City. I posed to them a hypothetical situation. Say your agricultural expert saw something that disturbed him. Would the standard operating procedure be for him to call the local police? Nope. It would be the handler. Again, a matter of the feds superseding everything else. Maybe these are just a bunch of good old boys who want to seem important. They can run around with their InfraGuard ID cards and impress their buddies at the club. And maybe the FBI sits back and says, "Well, this saves us a ton of money. We don't need agents out there because we've got these knuckleheads doing it." But this handler business is right out of CIA cloak and dagger. As head of a corporation, say you have someone working for you that happens to take a different political viewpoint. You can then call your handler, and the FBI will begin systematic harassment of that person. InfraGuard members supposedly receive warnings about alleged terrorist threats before the rest of us, and in return can ask the FBI to investigate disgruntled or annoying employees. Members also learn what their responsibilities are during periods of an emergency or even martial law. I asked one fellow I talked to, a former sheriff, "At any of your meetings, have you ever been told of a circumstance where you guys could use lethal force?" He said, "No, that's never been discussed." But we were told by a whistleblower that in the event martial law was ever declared, they would be granted that capability. They could protect whatever aspect of the infrastructure they were involved with and have permission to shoot to kill without fear of prosecution. So we're going to potentially turn loose a bunch of cowboys with guns who don't even know Miranda rights? That's a pretty scary proposition. And it's another step down the road to something like this. A month after Bush left office, a memo entitled "Authority for Use of Military Force to Combat Terrorist Activity Within the United States" came to light. Soon after 9/11, the Justice Department secretly gave the go-ahead for the military to attack apartment buildings or office complexes inside the country, and if necessary, to combat the terror threat, suspending press freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment. Military action might encompass making arrests, seizing documents or other property, searching persons or places, or keeping them under surveillance, intercepting electronic or wireless communications, setting up roadblocks, interviewing witnesses, or searching for suspects. As Kate Martin, director of the Center for National Security Studies think tank, put it bluntly, "In October 2001, they were trying to construct a legal regime that would basically have allowed for the imposition of martial law." Constitutional scholar Michael Ratner was even more blunt. He called the legal arguments Fuhrer's Law, and added, "The memos revealed how massive the takeover of our democracy was to be. They lay the groundwork for a massive military takeover of the United States in cahoots with the president, and if that's not a coup d'etat, then nothing is." Such plans date back a ways. During an earlier period of racial unrest and anti-Vietnam War protests, in 1968, the Pentagon came up with Operation Garden Plot. It was updated most recently in 1991 and activated briefly during the L.A. riots in 1992. The idea was for flexible military operations in urban terrain, using various kinds of high-tech weaponry and in concert with elite militarized police units that would be ready to stop disorder, disturbance, and civil disobedience in America. Then, during the Reagan years, Oliver North organized REX 84, short for Readiness Exercise 1984. I guess somebody had been taking their Orwell seriously. That envisioned using the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, created in 1979, to round up and detain in camps as many as 400,000 refugees in case of uncontrolled population movements coming across our border from Mexico. When North was asked during the Iran-Contra hearings about his work on a contingency plan in the event of emergency that would suspend the American Constitution, Chairman Daniel Inouye ruled that this highly sensitive and classified matter shouldn't be discussed in an open hearing. So who do you think was doing some of the top-level planning of this along with North? Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, along with Vice President Papa Bush, under something called the National Program Office. Rumsfeld and Cheney were principal actors in one of the most highly classified programs of the Reagan administration. Congress would have no role in the event of a national security emergency. 10 months before 9/11, immediately upon the second Bush administration taking control, Pentagon Chief Rumsfeld approved an updated version of the Army's COG plan. COG stands for Continuity of Government. The idea has been around since the 1950s, and the possibility that the Russians would drop a nuke on us. In May 2001, Bush put Cheney in charge of a terrorism task force and opened a new Office of National Preparedness within FEMA. The guy Bush had named ahead FEMA was Joe Albaugh, who'd managed the Bush-Cheney campaign in 2000 and helped out with the Dirty Tricks 19th floor riot that brought a halt to the ballot recount going on in Miami-Dade County. After 9/11, the COG plans went operational. Here's what the Washington Post reported 6 months later. President Bush has dispatched a shadow government of about 100 senior civilian managers to live and work secretly outside Washington, activating for the first time long-standing plans to ensure survival of federal rule after a catastrophic attack on the nation's capital. Known internally as the COG for continuity of government, the administration in waiting is an unannounced complement to the acknowledged absence of Vice President Cheney from Washington for much of the past 5 months. Under the new Homeland Security Office, another plan called Endgame was established. Its goal was to place all removable aliens and potential terrorists in detention facilities. Attorney General John Ashcroft came right out and announced his wish that such enemy combatants be put in camps scattered around the country. In January 2002, the Pentagon submitted a proposal for deploying troops on our streets, and that April the Northern Command, NORTHCOM, was set up to implement this. The command will provide civil support not only in response to attacks, but for natural disasters, according to the Pentagon's announcement. In September 2005, NORTHCOM conducted a highly classified exercise in D.C. called Granite Shadow. Bear in mind that the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 specifically outlaws the military acting like cops on our own soil. Bush also put through an executive order that changed the 1807 Insurrection Act, giving him much greater powers in the event of something he might label as insurrection. The Constitution lets habeas corpus be suspended during such an occurrence. This marked a fundamental change in military culture, according to Paul McHale, an Assistant Secretary for Homeland Defense. Before 9/11, he says, this would have been an extraordinary to the point of unbelievable. All through the Bush years, this kind of preparedness kept building. Early in 2006, as part of Endgame, Homeland Security awarded a $385 million contract to KBR, a subsidiary of Cheney's old company Halliburton, to get going on temporary detention and processing facilities in case there was an emergency influx of immigrants, or to support the rapid development of new programs with a natural disaster. Think Katrina, which saw the first roundup of citizens held not only in the football stadium in New Orleans, but shipped out to other detention centers. Shortly before the midterm elections, the Military Commissions Act of 2006 made it through Congress. This went so far as to permit the indefinite imprisonment of anybody who happened to give money to a charity on the terror watch list, or even someone who spoke out against these kinds of policies. Several more unbelievable dictums took effect in 2007, even after the Democrats regained control of Congress. The Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorist Prevention Act of 2007 passed the House 404-6, aimed at setting up a commission to examine and report upon the facts and causes of domestic extremism. The National Counterterrorism Center already has more than 775,000 terror suspects on its list. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act expands the definition of terrorism to include those who engage in sit-ins, civil disobedience, trespass, or any other crime in the name of animal rights. Section 1042 of the 2007 National Defense Authorization Act provided the executive branch power to impose martial law in response to a natural disaster, a disease outbreak, a terrorist attack, or any other condition in which the president determines that domestic violence has occurred to the extent that state officials cannot maintain public order. And the White House itself quietly put in place National Security Presidential Directive 52 to make sure continuity of government was intact, providing authority to cancel elections or suspend the Constitution in the event of a national emergency. Then what did we see in the course of the 2008 presidential election year? First of all, mass arrests at the Republican convention in St. Paul, including journalists arbitrarily thrown in the clink while filming the demonstrators. The 3rd Infantry Division, 1st Brigade Combat Team, was trained to do crowd control in Iraq. But on October 1st, between 3,000 and 4,000 of them got deployed in the U.S., ready to manage unruly individuals in case of a national emergency. One scenario envisioned by the Pentagon was civil unrest as a result of financial meltdown. They'd cooperate with FEMA on plans with code names like Vibrant Response and Excalibur. In November 2008, the U.S. Army War College came out with a study saying the military should be ready for a violent strategic dislocation inside the United States that could be provoked by unforeseen economic collapse, purposeful domestic resistance, pervasive public health emergencies, swine flu, or the loss of functioning political and legal order. The widespread civil violence would force the defense establishment to reorient priorities in extremis to defend basic domestic order and human security. Under the most extreme circumstances, this might include use of military force against hostile groups. And guess what, friends? It's already happening. There was a story recently in the Salinas, California paper about how violence and terrorism experts from the Naval Postgraduate School had been recruited to help combat the gang subculture in the agricultural town. U.S. Representative Sam Farr, a Democrat, was quoted, "The Naval Postgraduate School is trying to figure out how to stop violence anywhere in the world. Why not start in our own backyard?" Except for one thing, Congressman. It's illegal. Another story, in the Washington Post, no less, tells of how the military anticipates having 20,000 uniformed troops inside the U.S. by 2011, trained to help state and local officials respond to a nuclear terror attack or some other domestic catastrophe. This is part of a long-planned shift in the Department of Defense's role in homeland security. Already, an active-duty unit called the Chemical, Biological, Radiological, Nuclear, and Explosive Consequence Management Response Force is stationed at Fort Stewart, Georgia. And do you know about the fusion centers? These are much like InfraGuard, but more blatant. There are about 70 fusion centers around the U.S., places where local law enforcement, the private sector, and the intel community can share information in the fight against terrorism. One in West Texas finds it imperative to report on lobbying groups. Another in Virginia has declared that American universities, singling out several black colleges, have become radicalization nodes for potential terrorist activity. In September 2009, Homeland Security announced that these fusion centers would now have access to classified military intelligence in Pentagon databases. I've gone to some lengths to trace these developments since 9/11 because I'm a lot more afraid of this than the assault by Al-Qaeda. What's going on inside our military also frightens me. More and more we're seeing an army run by Christianist extremists and an accompanying cadre of what can only be described as neo-Nazis. Since the endless war on terror began, our armed services have been turning a blind eye to their own military statutes. Here's how a Department of Defense report stated it in 2005. Effectively, the military has a don't-ask-don't-tell policy pertaining to extremism. White supremacists are walking as enlisted men around our bases. There are the Hammerskins at Fort Hood and the Celtic Knights in Texas. One spokesman for the National Socialist Movement bragged about encouraging members to sign up for the military. We can use the training to secure the resistance to our government. Newsmax is an online website controlled by the ultra-right media baron Richard Mellon Scaife, who used to pay people to dig up dirt on Bill Clinton. Recently, one of Newsmax's columnists, John L. Perry, wrote about a gaining possibility that the military would stage a coup to resolve the Obama problem. It sounded like a page right out of the financial baron's plot to overthrow FDR. The coup would be civilized and bloodless, with a patriotic general getting together with the president to let him keep making speeches while a new system of skilled, military-trained nation-builders did the serious business of governing and defending the nation. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh has also warned that the military is in a war against the White House, and they feel they have Obama boxed in. Meantime, you've got news commentators like Glenn Beck warning about a looming insurrection. According to the FBI, there have been 5.5 million requests for background checks on potential gun buyers over the past year or so. The Southern Poverty Law Center reports unmistakable signs of a revival of what in the 1990s was commonly called the militia movement. It's estimated that 50 new militia training groups have sprung up over the last couple of years. There are people out there offering prep for what's coming, like the Front Sight Firearms Training Institute, founded by Dr. Ignatius Piazza. The millionaire patriot wants you armed and trained, and he is putting his money where his mouth is, ready to help you get a concealed weapon permit that's good in 30 states. I suppose, given all the illegal activity that the non-elected Bush administration engaged in since the millennium, we can't be too surprised at the reaction. A government that played on people's worst nightmares to achieve its own ends creates a culture not only of fear, but mistrust, to the point of insurrection, which is what they secretly seem to have been longing for. I went recently to Corcoran, Kansas, where a civilian is building state-of-the-art underground condos for wealthy people. I think they've got 12 units up for sale. These are being built on what used to be sites for launching nuclear missiles, so they were designed to withstand a nuclear attack. They go down 15 stories with about 15 feet of hardened concrete. Their plan is self-sustaining. They'll grow their own food and raise fish. They've figured out how much everyone can eat per day to sustain them up to 5 years. They'll each have a pool, a workout room, and a movie theater. I asked one buyer, "Well, you live in Florida. If the shit hits the fan, how are you going to get here?" He told me, "We have contingency plans." "But if all the electricity's gone, you're going to walk?" "If we have to," he said. "And you figure people are going to stand out there and hand you food while you make your journey?" "We have contingency plans," he said again. A different fellow I interviewed has been a bunker builder for 20 years, for rich people who want a safe shelter under their house to safeguard against hurricanes or tornadoes. He told me about a certain material that only a couple of vendors sell. In the course of the last decade, when he's tried to get it, he couldn't, because the government has bought them out. He said The government is building massive bunkers as fast as they possibly can. Why? What do they know that they're not telling the rest of us? I'm not suggesting that President Obama is part of such a scheme. He may not even be privy to it. But in the event of a national emergency, the bunkers would ensure continuity of government. Meantime, in a martial law scenario, all the technology is in place to impose government's will on the people. James Bamford, an author who specializes in what the National Security Agency is up to, says they're even developing an artificial intelligence system designed to know what people are thinking. Here come the thought police. Think about what our so-called technological advances really mean. Early in 2009, the National Security Archive in D.C. obtained an Information Operations Roadmap under a Freedom of Information Act request. This was signed by Rumsfeld in 2003, and it calls for electronic warfare in the form of computer network attack specialists and PSYOPs troops whose specialty is manipulating the beliefs of an enemy. At the Pentagon's request, a private company called the Lincoln Group planted hundreds of articles in Iraqi newspapers in support of U.S. policy. Information intended for foreign audience, including public diplomacy and PSYOPs, is increasingly consumed by our domestic audience. PSYOPs messages will often be replayed by the news media for much larger audiences, including the American people. CIA and FBI computers have already been used to edit Wikipedia entries on things like the Iraq War and Guantanamo. If that's not Big Brother enough, the document closes with the recommendation that the Pentagon ought to pursue an ability to provide maximum control of the entire electromagnetic spectrum, disrupt or destroy the full spectrum of globally emerging communication systems, sensors, and weapon systems dependent on the electromagnetic spectrum, which translates into being able to KO every telephone, network, computer, and radar system anywhere on the planet. Darth Vader, your time may be coming. Under the radar, a provision was slipped into the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization bill at the end of 2005. It's the DNA Fingerprint Act, meaning that if you get arrested at a demonstration on federal property, they can take a sample of your DNA and keep it on permanent file. This fits nicely with the billion-dollar FBI project to have a massive computer database containing individuals' physical characteristics. They call this biometrics, and it gives the government a brand new opportunity to identify folks at home and abroad. They're storing digital images of faces, fingerprints, and palm types in a climate-controlled underground facility in Clarksburg, West Virginia. They'll soon be crime-stopping, even by analyzing the way we walk and talk. At some airports, people who aren't line-standers at the metal detectors are taking advantage of the opportunity to have their irises scanned to prove they've passed a background check. That's called next-generation identification. In 2008, a three-judge appeals court, reversing a lower court's finding, ruled that federal border agents don't need any special reason to search laptops, cell phones, or digital cameras for evidence of crimes. Since Bush had already called for some high-tech measures to crack down on illegal immigration from Mexico, a company called VeriChip came up with a way to chip the foreigners. It's a radio frequency identification tag, RFID for short, encapsulated in glass and injected hypodermically into your skin. The ID number can be read right through your clothes by radio waves from very close range. Tommy Thompson, who headed up Health and Human Services under Bush, joined Verichep's board after he left the administration, and soon was out there extolling the merits of getting chipped as a means for Americans to link up to their medical records. The Pentagon has been entertaining talk of the RFIDs taking the place of the old military dog tags. It's also being marketed as a possible future way to make payments by combining the chip with your credit card. Microchips are already everywhere. They're putting chips in our credit cards, our cars, department store clothing tags, library books, literally everything but us. And I figure we're not far behind. I disconnected the North Star on my vehicle as soon as I bought it. I'd rather have to break my window to get my keys rather than have them know my location every time I drive anywhere. The RFID technology enabling both objects and people to be wirelessly tagged and tracked is on the edge of being a billion-dollar industry. Back in 2003, the Defense Department and Walmart teamed up to move RFID along by mandating their suppliers to put these radio tags on all their crates and cartons. Unlike barcodes, RFID chips don't fall under federal regulations, and they can be read without knowledge of the holder through just about anything except metal and water. Big corporations are excited about using miniaturized computers along with radio antennas to electronically sniff you. In 2005, American Express applied for a patent describing how RFID-embedded objects that shoppers carry could send out identification signals picked up by electronic consumer trackers. In return, the shoppers could be sent video ads offering them incentives to buy the products they'd seemed interested in. In 2006, IBM received patent approval for an invention it dubbed Identification and Tracking of Persons Using RFID-Tagged Items. Yet another patent, NCR Corporation, described using camouflaged sensors and video cameras to film your facial expression at counter displays, which allows one to draw valuable inferences about the behavior of large numbers of shoppers. Procter & Gamble went so far as to seek a patent to check out what you're examining on a lower shelf of the store. With tags in so many objects, relaying information to databases that can be linked to credit card bank cards, almost no aspect of life may soon be safe from the prying eyes of corporations and governments, says Mark Rash, who used to head the computer crime unit at the Justice Department. By putting sniffers in the right places, companies can invisibly rifle through people's pockets, purses, suitcases, briefcases, luggage, and possibly their kitchens and bedrooms any time of the day or night. Under our Constitution and Bill of Rights, government is not allowed to do certain things. Corporate America doesn't fall under those same rules, so the government is getting the private sector to do the dirty work. Violations that they can't be held accountable for. Then the corporations simply take the information they've acquired and turn it over to the government. You might say, what else could they learn? Well, things like this. Say you've got health care coming up. If they know everything you buy in the store, they might say, here's a candidate for diabetes. Look how he eats. Let's pass this along because you could be a risk. I know I was surveilled when I was governor of Minnesota. To this day, every time I start appearing on national TV or radio, all of a sudden my phones get weird. You hear clicks on the other end. And my wife can't get online as quickly, and things disappear from her computer. Is this happenstance? It always seems to coincide with when I take a high profile. If you're at all a dissenter, apparently you will be observed and put under surveillance. Doesn't it also concern you that we, the rabble, could be looking at a corporatized, militarized future where we're tracked down by radio tags and herded into camps for undesirable citizens who won't go along with the program? Not to worry if you're part of the elite. The insurance giant AIG has pioneered a special service for customers living in upper-class zip codes. During the 2007 wildfires in Southern California, its private client group paid big bucks to AIG's Firebreak spray systems to have their homes hosed down with a fire retardant, sometimes while the next-door neighbor went up in flames. A startup company called Sovereign Deed, tied into the mercenary outfit Triple Canopy, has since developed our first privatized national disaster response center with a country club-type membership fee. Do you realize that since 2002, there has been a 47% increase in American workers classified as security guards? And that, as high as one-quarter of our labor force, is now centered around protection instead of production? That's a culture increasingly based on fear. And as Benjamin Franklin said in 1775, those who give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. We don't have to put up with this. When everything is built on lies, it's built on nothing, isn't it? It's a house of cards waiting to fall. I'd like to believe that we as a people can handle the truth, but we don't have a free media anymore. They're corporatized and controlled. The proof is in the pudding when Bush got caught paying off journalists to espouse the administration's line. You don't see much investigative reporting like we had in the old days. So where do we the people start? I say by demanding prosecution of the politicians who condone torture on their lying road into Iraq, and by a new legitimate investigation into what happened on September 11th, a tragedy that's been used ever since to justify all the lies and undermine our democratic freedoms. With President Obama, we voted for a fresh start, but now we've got to hold his feet to the fire and get to the bottom of what's happened to our country over these recent decades. I've not written this book because I get off on talking about conspiracies. I've written it because until we face the terrible reality of the assassinations and the governmental drug dealing and the stolen elections and the rest, until we look at how, slowly and insipidly, the most venal of men took control of our nation, we don't stand a chance of putting things back on track. I'm not saying that knowledge sets us free, but it does force us to wake up and realize that we're on the brink of losing everything the founders of our country stood for and bequeathed to us. Single acts of tyranny may be ascribed to the accidental opinion of a day, but a series of oppressions begun at a distinguished period and pursued unalterably through every change of ministers, too plainly prove a deliberate, systematic plan of reducing a people to slavery. Thomas Jefferson, Rights of British America, 1774. Cherish the spirit of our people, and keep alive their attention. Do not be too severe upon their errors, but reclaim them by enlightening them. Thomas Jefferson, 1787. Words to live by. Thank you, Mr. Jefferson.